You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey folks, Ben Mathis here with a couple important announcements. You know that we have great advertisers that support the show and keep it free for you to listen. And one of the reasons why advertisers love Kick-Ass News is that they know the show has amazing listeners. Right now, we have a survey that I'd like you to take to help us learn more about our audience. Just go to podsurvey.com/kick. The survey will only take 5 minutes. We're going to ask you some questions about yourself and what you like to buy, but it's completely anonymous, and your answers will help us find advertisers that are well matched to you, your interests, and the show. And as a way of saying thank you, when you're finished, you can enter a monthly drawing to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Even if you've taken our podcast listener survey before, I'd like to ask you to take this one and help support the show. It'll be a big help to me, and don't forget that you have a chance to win that $100 Amazon gift card. Once again, that's podsurvey.com/kick. That's K-I-C-K. Thanks for helping us find the best advertisers so that we can keep the show free. Also, the holidays are upon us, and if you're like me, you'll skip the madness of the stores and do most of your shopping on Amazon this year. And if you're going to be doing that anyway, then help support the show by going to the sponsor page on our website at kickassnews.com and copying and pasting the Amazon link there into your web browser before you start ordering. Then Amazon will toss us a little something for every purchase you make this holiday season. You have to shop for gifts anyways. They've got just about everything you can imagine on Amazon delivered right to your door. It won't cost you anything extra, and you can help support the show. So it's kind of like giving 2 gifts for the price of 1 this year. And that, my friends, is what you call a Christmas miracle. So again, go to the sponsor page at kickassnews.com and copy our Amazon link into your web browser before you start shopping. And if you feel extra generous this Christmas, then make a donation to keep us going over here at GoFundMe.com/kickassnews. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast.
What draws my admiration? What is that which gives me joy?
Dames.
Baseball. A man stands alone at a plate. This is the time for what? For individual achievement. There he stands alone. But in the field, what? Part of a team.
Teamwork.
Bats himself the livelong day, Babe Ruth, Ty Cobb, and so on. team don't field, what is he? You follow me? No one. Sunny day, stands are full of fans. What does he have to say? I'm going out there for myself. But I get nowhere unless the team wins.
Team.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
That's a scene from the 1987 film The Untouchables, in which Al Capone, played by Robert De Niro, ruins a black-tie gangsters-only banquet by bashing in the head of a disloyal associate with a baseball bat. The scene has since been included in biographies and documentaries about the notorious mobster, but the problem is, according to my guest today, that scene probably never happened. Award-winning author Deirdre Baer dispels that and other myths and digs deep into the man who ruled Chicago with an iron fist in her new biography called Al Capone, His Life, Legacy, and Legend. Deirdre Baer is the critically acclaimed author of 5 award-winning biographies on Samuel Beckett, Simone de Beauvoir, Anais Nin, Carl Jung, and Saul Steinberg. She's also the author of the cultural study, Calling It Quits, Late Life Divorce, and Starting Over. She received the National Book Award for her biographies on Samuel Beckett and Simone de Beauvoir, and those books, along with Carl Jung, were finalists for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. Her biographies of Beauvoir, Anais Nin, and Steinberg were chosen by the New York Times as Best Books of the Year, and Carl Jung won the Gradiva Award from the National Association for the Advancement of Psychoanalysis as the Best Biography of the Year. Deirdre Baer has appeared on CBS's The Early Show, NBC's Today Show, PBS's Fresh Air, Charlie Rose, Brian Lehrer, and other TV programs. Today, she comes on the show to talk about her book, Al Capone, His Life, Legacy, and Legend. She'll share how she got unprecedented access to the surviving relatives of Al Capone and how their stories, passed down through the family, revealed the human side of the notorious gangster. She'll cut through some of the many myths and legends surrounding Capone, including the famous baseball bat scene. She'll discuss how he was quickly able to move up in and then take over the Johnny Torrio gang, and how his business acumen led none other than the Harvard Business School to do a case study on his illegal empire. She'll talk about the security measures he put in place, including a bulletproof desk chair, secret tunnels, and throngs of bodyguards, famously referred to as Capone's Wall of Meat. She'll divulge where the gangster hid out when things got too hot in Chicago, and why he once got arrested on purpose. She'll dispel the myth of Elliot Ness and talk about the people who really caught Al Capone, including one prominent lady lawyer in the 1920s. Plus, Al Capone's insatiable need for publicity, and how that sat with his camera-shy contemporaries at the head of the other mafia families. And finally, how the man who was once King of Chicago met his pitiful fate not at the end of a gun, but mentally debilitated and ravaged by neurosyphilis. Coming up with author Deirdre Baer in just a moment. Today I'm joined by 2-time winner of the National Book Award, author-biographer Deirdre Baer. Her new book is Al Capone, His Life, Legacy, and Legend. Deirdre Baer, thanks for joining me over the phone.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
This is an interesting departure for you, I guess I would say. In past books, you've covered figures that have included Samuel Beckett, Anais Nin, Simone de Beauvoir, Carl Jung, Saul Steinberg. Your current subject could not possibly be more different from those. Why Al Capone?
This one was really different. A friend of mine in publishing came to me and said that a gentleman named Capone wondered about how closely related he was to Al Capone, and he wanted to find out his family's history. And she said he was looking for someone to help him. And so I replied facetiously. I said, you know, is he looking for a private detective? I'm a writer. And she said, well, I think he wants a writer. I think he wants someone to help him find out his family's history. So one thing led to another. I said, did he want a historian? Did he want a ghost writer? Did he want an as told to? And in the process of talking to him and some other members of his family, I just realized that this was a side of Al Capone that had never been known before. These people were family members, and they were interested in finding out their own family history. Some of them were quite old, had been alive when Al Capone was alive. Granted, they were young, but they had many memories of him. Others only knew the stories that were handed down from generation to generation. And one thing led to another, and I got hooked, and I wrote the book.
So it wasn't hard to get members of Capone's own family to actually step forward and talk about him at this point?
In some instances, it was quite easy because they said they were very old and they did not want their stories to die with them. They wanted to tell their memories of Al Capone. In other instances, some members of the family said, I'll tell you everything I knew, everything I heard, but you can't use my name. Others were reluctant at first, but then when they saw that everybody else was talking to me, they decided to do what I call jumping on the train before it leaves the station. And so anyway, you know, gradually over time, my sociologist friends call this snowball sampling, that one person leads to another who brings in another and so on. So that's how the book progressed.
And with Capone, there are so many legends and apocryphal stories, conflicting accounts of his life. Did it seem like a daunting task to get to the real man underneath all of the Capone mythology?
Oh, it certainly was a daunting task. Just to give you one example, when I was writing about the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, I think I had at least 12 different books dealing specifically with that event spread out all over my study, and every one of them had something different to say about Al Capone. So, you know, there were many conclusions. That was one of them that eluded me. I finally had to say, yes, he probably directed the massacre, but he made sure he was in Miami and very far from the actual event when it happened.
And one of the things that was interesting in the book is I've always thought of Al Capone as a typical gangster, kind of a dumb thug who just got ahead through violence. But you talk about how as a kid, he got good grades in school. He had a gift for math. He was interested in culture and bettering himself. He later always read the newspaper and kept up on current events. I'm curious, would you say that Al Capone was an intelligent man and perhaps even intelligent enough that he might have thrived in the legitimate business world as, say, a CEO if he had chosen that path?
Well, just to give you one example of how highly his intelligence is regarded, the Harvard Business School did a case study of how Al Capone ran the Chicago outfit. Imagine spending a semester learning how to be a managerial business person by studying Al Capone, but that's something that really happened. I think he was incredibly intelligent, and you know, so many other people besides me have compared him to various titans of industry and commerce, and it's commonly said, well, you know, if he had been born maybe 20 years later, he could have been a Lee Iacocca running an automobile company. I really do think that's true. he liked to read, and we have his library cards from when he was in Alcatraz, and there he was educating himself, reading biographies of Napoleon, for example.
Yeah.
So, yeah, people who have studied various business, we'll call them business pursuits of Al Capone, have concluded this is, really was a very smart man.
And at one point, he did briefly go legit. There was a period when he was a newlywed with a child. He took a job as a legitimate bookkeeper for a construction company in Baltimore, and that was his shot to go straight after he had gone around with some gangs in New York in his younger years. Why did he turn back to a life of crime?
Well, I think it was because of the early death of his father. His father died when he was 59 years old, and although Al's three older brothers were out on their own, Al's mother at home had one daughter and three younger sons. Al had a wife who he loved dearly, and they had a newborn son who was very sickly. He was ill for most of his life. He didn't actually, Sonny, the one child they had, didn't go to school until he was 12 years old. He was schooled at home. But here suddenly was Al Capone in charge of eight people, including himself. He had to provide for them. And the only way he could do that in the limited world that he knew and in which he lived was to work for Johnny Torrio, a mob boss, a gangster.
Yeah, and he quickly rose through the ranks in Johnny Torrio's gang in New York and then in Chicago. Torrio was something of a father figure to him. What did Al Capone learn from Johnny Torrio?
Well, I think the major thing that Al Capone learned from Johnny Torrio was how to keep his hands clean, how to sit on the sidelines and delegate all the dirty work to other people, never really to do it himself. He learned how to be a manager. He also learned from Johnny Torrio. Johnny Torrio was famous for his expression, "There's enough to go around for everybody. We don't need to be killing each other." And that's what Al Capone tried to do. I became fascinated by Johnny Torrio when I wrote about Al Capone. And I came to the conclusion that he was really the first genius mob boss. And I believe he deserves a biography of his own,
yeah.
But I'm not going to write it. Somebody else can have that one.
Yeah, and the one thing that Al Capone didn't copy from Johnny Torrio was Johnny Torrio's desire to stay under the radar and lead a quiet life and not attract a lot of attention. Al Capone loved attention, loved publicity. Why did he have this need to be in the public eye?
You know, I credit Al Capone with being the first one to use spin. I credit him with being the inventor of spin. He knew how to use the media. And indeed, he did not stay under the radar. His clothes were absolutely the flashiest. He wore banana yellow and chartreuse suits. He had a white fedora. Other gangsters didn't wear white fedoras because Al Capone was always the target of somebody who was out to do a whack job on him. And so to wear a white fedora meant you were Al Capone, and other gangsters avoided that. He would invite reporters into his mother's house, into his mother's kitchen. And on one occasion, he was standing there in a pink apron, stirring a pot of spaghetti. He never cooked. His mother never let him near a stove. So, you know, he just manipulated the media. He had editors and reporters on his payroll. He tried to hire the most famous public relations consultant in those early years in the 1920s. The man's name was Ivy Lee, and he had turned around the reputation of people like John D. Rockefeller and Standard Oil, or Charles Lindbergh, who had reputed Nazi sympathies.
Right.
And so Al thought, well, you know, this is the guy to help me in my troubles with the IRS, who were trying to put him in jail for tax evasion. And, of course, Ivy Lee very wisely decided that Al Capone was not the kind of client that he wanted or needed.
And what was Al Capone's relationship like with his contemporaries at the head of other gangs like Lucky Luciano and Meyer Lansky in New York? Did they bristle at his need for publicity?
They did. And as a matter of fact, he was not invited to what is generally believed to be the first gang summit that was held in Cleveland. But he was invited to one in Atlantic City, and when the other gang leaders tried to meet very quietly in sedate business suits and quiet hotels, Al Capone was right out there, right on the boardwalk in Atlantic City, in his flashy clothes and his diamond pinky ring and his white fedora, entertaining anybody who wanted to talk to him.
And once he took over Johnny Torrio's gang, he got embroiled in what they called now the Chicago Beer Wars. He always had a target on his head, it seems. If I was, say, a rival gang and wanted to bump off Al Capone, what kind of security would I have had to get through to get to him?
Oh, my goodness. Well, first of all, he always rode when he was out in public in a reinforced car. He had two or three of them. So, you know, some people say it was a Cadillac and other people say it was a Duesenberg or whatever. But he had two or three of these cars that he had armor plated at a very significant expense. They had bulletproof glass. They also had back windows that could be lowered so that machine guns could be placed there and shots could be fired from the back window. So he had two or three of these. He traveled in that entourage. And within the various hotels where he had his headquarters in Chicago, you had to go through tremendous security in the lobby. And then when you got off the elevator on the floor where Al had his offices, you had to go through a phalanx of bodyguards. Somebody called them, I think it was in the New Yorker, an article was written about him, and they called it Al Capone's Wall of Meat, huge bodyguards. And then if you did manage to get into his office, there were, of course, people with guns surrounding him. So, you know, you couldn't make a false move.
And you said even his desk chair was bulletproof.
Yes, two of his henchmen gave him a chair. He had his desk set into the windows. He was, you know, 4 to 12 stories up in these various hotels. But he did like to sit in the window and look out at the city of Chicago, which he did own. So they had the back of the chair bulletproofed so that if he had his back to the windows and someone tried to shoot him, they'd shoot the chair and the bullets wouldn't get through.
And I think you said that there were also hidden doors and secret underground passageways at these hotels so he could make a quick escape if he needed to?
Well, there were underground passageways, but they weren't so secret because of the terrible winters in Chicago. On the main streets, particularly under Michigan Avenue, the stores, the buildings, were connected by underground passageways so that deliveries could be made and goods could be shipped back and forth and services rendered. So they weren't all that secret, but certainly they were underground passageways.
During this period of the Chicago Beer Wars, and this was a time when other gangsters, like gangsters in New York, would refer to Chicago as just some crazy, you know, Wild West kind of place, even by their standards. Al Capone often had to drop off the radar and disappear for a bit. He would leave town or he would stay with a friend. Apparently, It was getting harder and harder, though, for him to find any town that would accept him, right?
True enough. He would go. He had friends in Northbrook, friends who worked for him in the outfit, and they had big estates that were carefully guarded. So he went there to that Chicago suburb. He went over to Lansing, Michigan, a couple of times. He was on the Chicago Dunes. But he and his brother, his older brother, Ralph, who was his right-hand man in the outfit, they bought property in northern Wisconsin near Hayward and Mercer, places up there. And so the townspeople there, many of them are still alive. I had a wonderful time talking to people in northern Wisconsin, and they would tell me about how all of a sudden you would see this fleet of huge black armored cars roaring through town on their way to the hideouts, the Capone hideouts. And they have funny stories to tell about how their parents would say to them, now, if you see those black cars or you see the guys in them getting out of the cars, you run and you hide, you duck, you get away. So they went up there a lot. But there would be months at a time that he couldn't leave his hotel or he couldn't leave wherever he was hiding out because the beer wars were so ferocious and he was a target.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back to talk more with author Deirdre Baer when we come back in just a minute. If you're interested in my conversation today, you should check out Al Capone, His Life, Legacy, and Legend by my guest today, Deirdre Baer. And right now, you can download the audio version of her book for free with a special promotion just for our listeners from Audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickassnews for a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download, which can be Al Capone, His Life, Legacy, and Legend by Deirdre Baer, or any of Audible's 180,000 titles. That's audibletrial.com/kickassnews. Or click on the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And now, back to the show. It sounds like a kind of miserable existence in the last few years of his career in organized crime. At one point, you talk about his wife and he went to Los Angeles ostensibly on a vacation, perhaps to scope out muscling into some of the entertainment unions. And the police met him at the station as he got off the train and basically told him he wasn't welcome there. And the hotel all but canceled his reservation after a night or so.
Absolutely. May, his wife, she was such a marvelous woman, such an incredible person. And at one point, May said she knew every terrible thing he had done, but she still loved him anyway. And at this period of time, she just really needed to get out of the Chicago winters and the household where her mother-in-law and Al's sister, Mafalda, were quite mean to her, actually.
Yeah.
So Al said, sure, let's go to California. They were muscling into all the unions in the film industry and various other industries. And so they got on the train and they went to Los Angeles, and they're waiting to greet the train when it arrived at Union Station. Were various Los Angeles officials, including the police chief, who said, you have to get right back on that train and go back to Chicago. So Al persuaded them to let him keep his hotel reservation for a day or two. And they were allowed to stay over long enough to, I guess, get their land legs again before they had to get back on the train. But so many interesting myths surrounding Al Capone grew up out of that day or two in Los Angeles. He was said to have gone to the races at Caliente in Baja California. Well, that racetrack didn't come into being until, I think, a year and a half later. He was said to have built all kinds of tunnels in the sand on the beach around Ensenada. He never got to Mexico. He never built any.
And that would have been a long drive in those days, too.
Well, yeah. And also, you know, there was no need to smuggle booze into Mexico. Mexico never had prohibition. So that entire, his 2 days in Los Angeles, he would have had to be there, say, 3 or 4 months to have done all the myths and the legends that grew up around him.
But the rather shabby welcome that he got, it sounds like that was pretty common of most of his travels.
Yes, it was. He really did want a second home, and he tried to buy one in all sorts of towns. New Orleans, for example, they kicked his, he sent his two brothers down there to scout out properties, and the town officials kicked them out and said, "We don't want you here." And there was actually a wonderful newspaper article. An Iowa town said, "Al Capone, you can come here anytime." And when they voted for mayor, Al Capone got more votes than the actual mayor. So, but eventually he ended up in Miami. And he had a beautiful home in Miami. And his wife, May, was so happy. It was the first home she ever had, in which her mother-in-law and the rest of Al's family were not living full-time. They were there all the time, but they weren't full-time residents. And he loved the place. He loved the place in Miami. And it's actually where he died. He died in 1947 when he was 48.
And the relationship between Al Capone and his wife, May, who was an Irish girl, is really at the heart of this book. How would you characterize their marriage?
May was an absolutely remarkable woman. It was such an unusual marriage for so many different reasons. At that time, Italians, particularly in Brooklyn, who married an Irish girl, that was considered to be a mixed marriage. And the Italian was known by that euphemism, colored. May was determined to marry Al. They were deeply in love. They met at the box factory where they both worked. It was one of Al's few legitimate jobs. And she was 2 years older than Al. And they became sexually active shortly after they met. And she became pregnant. Unlike most Irish girls who were, quote unquote, sent away to visit a relative, May stayed home. It was a very difficult pregnancy. Her mother, who was widowed, wouldn't let May and Al marry. And the reason, the family thinks the main reason was because the pregnancy was so difficult that May's mother hoped that it would end in miscarriage. The baby was born 2 months early. He was premature and he was sickly. But 3 weeks after he was born, May married Al. And she didn't marry him in his little, tiny, very poor Italian Catholic church. She married him in St. Mary Star of the Sea, which was the big, rich Irish church in Brooklyn. She was strong, that woman, and she would have had to have been strong to put up with the life that she led with her husband until the last years, until after he was released from prison, which were the happiest years of her life. I have some photos in my book that were given to me by the family, and she's just grinning from ear to ear. She's so happy to be there with her husband.
Do you think that she had a good sense of what went on in his other life when he wasn't around her?
Oh, she knew everything. one of my favorite stories, Al liked bleached blonde, peroxide blonde, women for his mistresses, and every now and again he'd get one mistress that he favored, and he'd set her up, take her out of the brothel where he met her, and set her up in her own apartment. And May had lovely, lustrous, brown, dark brown, chestnut brown hair. And one day when Al came home after a long absence to one of his mother's Sunday dinners, May was in the kitchen with her head covered with a scarf, covered entirely with a scarf. And when all the men sat down at the dining table for their meal, May stood over the table and whipped off the scarf, showing peroxide blonde hair, which she kept for the rest of her life. But at that particular moment, Al Capone said nothing. He just ate his pasta. She knew. She had a sharp hearing, and she could see, and she was a smart woman. And when his henchmen would gather at 3 o'clock in the morning after some heinous deed, and she had to get out of bed and make spaghetti for them, she heard, she knew everything that went on.
And I want to ask you about his famous temper. There's this famous scene where he's at a meeting with some of his associates in a private room at a restaurant, and it's in the movie The Untouchables, and it's referenced all the time, where he starts lecturing them on teamwork and baseball, and then he bashes one of his associates' head in with a baseball bat. Did that really happen?
What really happened was two men, Anselmi and Scalise, turned against him. They were recruited by another mob, or so he heard. We don't really know that they actually accepted to eliminate Al, to kill him, but he thought they did. So he invited them to a dinner. The place of the dinner has never been verified. What happened at the dinner has never been verified beyond this fact, that they were killed. They were put into their car and driven to Hammond, Indiana, across the border from Illinois, from Chicago, right on the lake. And they were, their bodies were riddled with bullets, and the car was set on fire. That much is true. That event actually happened. That murder took place. Where it took place, we don't know. Was there a baseball bat in the room? We don't know that. That was in movies. It was in books. It was elaborated upon until by the time we got to that incredible, stunning scene with Robert De Niro and the baseball bat. It's wonderful drama and wonderful fiction. And it could have happened. Maybe parts of it are true, but we don't know the entire truth of it. All we know is that Anselmi and Scalise were put in their car, driven to Hammond, Indiana. Their bodies were riddled with bullets, and their car was set on fire. That's all we know.
Which ought to be enough.
I should say.
Yeah. And another example of one of these stories that we only kind of got half the story on was at one point, I think in the late 20s, when things were getting pretty hot for him, he got arrested on a gun violation in Philadelphia, and he was sent to jail there. You say that that was entirely intentional on his part. Why did Al Capone want to go to jail?
So Al Capone decided that Philadelphia was a good town to go to jail in because he had a lot of people there who were working for him or who would protect him, and he was tired, actually. He was exhausted from the beer wars, and he needed a rest. And he thought he'd be sent, he thought he would be given a term of, you know, 1 month, 2 months, great time to hide out, to recoup, to figure what comes next. Well, he had a punitive judge who sentenced him to 13 months. He hadn't expected that.
Yeah, and it sounds like he had bad luck with judges in general, because when he finally did get caught and went to prison, I guess he had already arrived at a plea deal through his lawyer with the prosecutor, and the judge just decided not to accept it, huh?
The whole trial, as one of the lawyers in 1990 who was involved in a retrial said, well, that was Chicago then, intimating that even those within the legal system were oftentimes not entirely legal. There were so many inconsistencies in Al Capone's trial. And Judge Wilkerson, who presided over his trial, did a really smart thing. He knew that the jury pool had been corrupted, that Al had bribed most of the jury pool. So he knew that another judge had a trial that was starting on the exact same day as his. And so at the very last minute, the judge said, well, we're going to have a half an hour hiatus before the trial starts. And at that point, he switched pools with the other judge so that and there was no chance for Al Capone to contaminate the new jury. And they were upstanding Protestant farmers, small business people who had probably never seen an Italian-American, let alone known one. And they were staunch upholders of prohibition, and they just convicted Al Capone up one side and down the other.
Today, looking back, in popular lore, Elliot Ness gets so much of the attention for being the man who, quote-unquote, caught Al Capone. But you don't devote much of the book to him, and in fact, you say that while he got headlines for raiding Capone's breweries and his speakeasies, he actually had very little to do with sending him to prison. So who were the people who were most instrumental in convicting Al Capone?
Actually, it was two or three very quiet little accountants who were tiny little fish in the IRS and the FBI. There was a woman lawyer, Mabel Walker Willebrand, who was a staunch enemy of prohibition. She's a very interesting woman, and she's been written about in a number of books about women lawyers in the 1920s. And she was determined that you couldn't get him on any charges relating to crime, but you could get him on tax evasion. And she persuaded a number of other accountants that if you followed the money, you could put Al Capone in jail. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, Ness did go out and line up reporters from Chicago newspapers to come and watch him with a sledgehammer bashing a keg of booze. But it was those accountants who worked behind the scenes very quietly and diligently for two or three years. They're the ones who put him in jail.
And by the time he went to trial and eventually went to prison, prohibition was on the verge of being repealed anyway. If he hadn't gone to prison, did Al Capone have a post-prohibition business plan? And how do you think he would have fared without all that liquor revenue?
Jake Guzik, who was his business manager, if you will, within the outfit, said, you know, we have to do other things. There really, I couldn't find very much mention of drugs. So I don't think that at the time there was any plan to go heavily into the business of drugs. However, they worried that their revenues from brothels and from gambling were going to be cut significantly. And so they already were thinking, you know, what can we do? What can we go into? And Al Capone joked about the milk business, that he should have gone into the milk business because it was legit. People always needed to drink milk.
You mentioned his brothel business. Apparently, his involvement in prostitution was a touchy subject. Even though it brought him a good amount of income, he didn't want the label of being a pimp.
There are so many inconsistencies in the personality of Al Capone. And this is one of them. He made a very good living from the brothels. He enjoyed the wares, shall we say. He took advantage of the women. Some of them he actually took out of prostitution and set them up into becoming his mistress for a period of time, or then helping them find a husband or go off into a legitimate life. And yet, I had Al Capone's medical records, and anytime anyone, a doctor or a psychologist, would bring up the subject of prostitution, he would become violently angry. He would go off on a tirade. He did not want anyone to associate him taking advantage of women.
The popular lore has it that when he went to Alcatraz, his health suffered greatly, and by the time he was released, his mind was already starting to be ravaged by neurosyphilis. How quickly did he succumb to the disease and begin to lose his mind?
By 1934, when he was in Alcatraz, he was being routinely treated. The problem is the treatment that they gave him, the drugs, the pills, whatever, had been questioned since as early as 1906. And so here he was, 1932 to 37, being given outmoded treatment that they knew wasn't going to work. So he was released early from Alcatraz because he was in such terrible shape. And by the time he got to first to Baltimore and then to Miami for treatment, but between two doctors, Doctors Phillips and Moore, he had the mentality of somewhere between a 7-year-old and a 12-year-old. He fluctuated. Yet when he was with his wife, when he was with May and his granddaughters, who were old enough to have known him, they said he always behaved like a responsible adult. And that was because of May. Even when he was in Alcatraz and he would be acting out in uncontrollable rages and so on, whenever he wrote to May or whenever May came to visit, he was fine. She and the rest of the family did everything they could to protect him, to keep him from anything that would set off that hair-trigger temper that he had. But he really, he was severely mentally impaired.
I noticed in the book that when you weren't using his full name, you usually referred to him as Al instead of Capone or Mr. Capone. It almost seemed like I detected a note of affection for him. Did you find certain redeeming qualities about Al Capone?
When I was trying to assess the personality of Al Capone, this vicious killer, the streets of Chicago were awash in blood. There was no question that he incited violence and he approved of it, and he participated in it. Who knows how many killings, anywhere from 300 to 700 killings took place in Chicago, for many of which, most of which, his men, his outfit, were responsible for. So there was that really terrible side of Al Capone, and yet here was this devoted husband and father and brother, all of these people that he took care of, people within his outfit. If someone became ill, if someone was killed, he took care of their families. So we had this this dichotomy. When I talked to family members, we'd use words like, well, he was a riddle. He was in a conundrum. He was an enigma. There was so much more to the totality of Al Capone, so that he was not easy to slot into any one final category. You notice I called him Al when he was with his family, mm-hmm. when he was with Ralph and May and his mother, Teresa. That's when he was Al. Because that's when he was, shall I say, the most human.
Mm-hmm. He was so careful, as we already discussed, and spent so much time and money trying to craft a public image of himself. How do you think he would have wanted to be remembered?
You know, I think he would have wanted to be remembered as a benefactor. He often said, "I only give the people what they want." And in a very large sense, that's very true. He did. He'd say, "I was a businessman, and I was selling people what they wanted." And, you know, he did set up a soup kitchen in the Depression. He fed over 3,000 people a day a hot meal, not a cold sandwich and an apple, but a hot meal. Well, yeah, but then there are people who say, sure, he was able to do this because he extorted the food from other small businesses and never paid for any of it himself. I think he would enjoy all the ways in which his name is used today, But I think the ones that he would really care about and wish to promote would be the ones that have him doing good deeds.
Well, the book is a terrific read. I highly recommend it. It's called Al Capone, His Life, Legacy, and Legend. Deirdre Baer, thanks for talking with me.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks again to Deirdre Baer for joining me. And if you enjoyed today's podcast, you can order her book, Al Capone, His Life, Legacy, and Legend, on Amazon. Or you can also download the audio version for free through that special trial offer just for our listeners at audibletrial.com/kickassnews. And visit her website at deirdrebaerauthor.com, deirdrebaerauthor.com. Don't forget to take our listener survey so we can keep the show free and find advertisers who are best matched to you, our listeners. Just take 5 minutes to go to podsurvey.com/kick and take the survey. And when you're done, be sure to register for that $100 Amazon gift card giveaway. And once again, before you start your Amazon shopping this Christmas, visit the sponsor page on our website at kickassnews.com and copy our Amazon link into your web browser first. Then Amazon will kick us a little coin for every order you make this season. Be sure to subscribe to Kickass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. You can visit Kickass News on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at KAPolitics. And please be sure to recommend Kickass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/kickassnews. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kickass News. Kickass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.